Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 17th of November. This hour of the program, we've heard so much about high-speed rail in the state of Wisconsin. We thought it was time to step back and take a look at the history of rail in this country. The railroad revolutionized, really, transportation in the United States at the beginning of the 19th century. Rivers, canals, and horse-drawn coaches were the options for moving people and goods within the country. Railroads enabled an efficiency and carrying capacity that had never been seen before. They linked the nation, carrying people and raw materials and agriculture products. The relative speed and the ability to travel, regardless of the weather, made rail travel attractive to travelers and businesses. And by 1840, 2,818 miles of track were laid down. By the start of the Civil War, 30,000 miles of track had been laid. And we are going to be talking about the history after those years, the importance of Abraham Lincoln to making sure we got a transcontinental railroad. And we'll, of course, look at the current controversy here in the state of Wisconsin, but we will be informed by our history. We have two guests with us this hour. Bob Lettenberger is the education director and volunteer services director of a museum. I'm embarrassed to say I haven't been there, but I hear it is just outstanding. It is the National Railroad Museum in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And we thank you so much, Bob, for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you this morning.
Peter Hansen also joining us, editor of Railroad History, the scholarly journal of the Railway and Locomotive Historical Society, and correspondent for Trains Magazine, a contributor to the Encyclopedia of North American Railroads. We'll be welcoming phone calls for everybody this hour. Peter, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah.
Good to be here.
Yeah, we should have a really good conversation. I've been looking forward to this. I come from, as you can imagine, a long line of people who laid the tracks in Illinois because we were Irish, and that's what people did when they came over here.
Right.
So I got that history. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you want to send an email, do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. You know, one thing that struck me in reading some of the history of the rail in this country is that we had some pretty high-speed rail a long time ago, say in the 1930s. Why did we have it then, and what happened?
Well, I think what happened, Kathleen, is that we decided that there were other transportation options that we would prefer to pursue, or at least as a matter of public policy we did. A lot of this, I think, oddly enough, goes back over 100 years. Because there was a lot of antipathy that built up against the railroads during the days when they had a virtual monopoly on land transportation. And when other alternatives presented themselves, highways and later on air travel, there was a great hue and cry to fund those options publicly. We did not do the same for rail travel, and over time, rail travel increasingly was at a competitive disadvantage simply because it didn't have access to the public funding.
And why didn't it?
Well, I think it was, again, just because of that antipathy that developed against the railroads back during the robber baron years. You know, people had a tremendous reserve of ill will against the railroads, and not unreasonably so. There were a lot of excesses that occurred back during those times, and when there were alternatives, people wanted them.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about how difficult it is, Daniel, to build a railroad, to lay the tracks, the development of the technology to have trains in the world. Was that a hard thing to do?
You know, when the railroads came about, it was new technology. And people early on, even in our country, were afraid of it. It was an unknown entity. In fact, if you go back to some of the very early times, and the railroads were touting the fact that they could achieve speeds of 25, 30, 35 miles an hour, there were people that believed that the human body, if it reached that speed, would suddenly fall into unconsciousness.
Oh my goodness, you're kidding.
and when you look at that kind of public fear, and you translate that into the actual building of the railroads, we're dealing with an entity that was completely unknown. How do you handle it? How do you regulate it? What's it going to do to my backyard? And some of the initial approaches to railroads there was both positive and negative. There was a great deal of anticipation in getting a railroad so that a community could reap the economic benefits. Yet there was the fear of this iron horse coming into my town, polluting it, having accidents, killing people. And you see some of those same traits carrying all the way through history, even up to today.
Well, that's interesting. So they were saying, instead of the iron horse, give me my regular horse, or what?
Well, there was some of that argument, yes. But the other part of the argument, the forethought of businessmen, was the idea that, you know, in our country, when you go back to the 1820s, 1830s, even 1840s, we were a country that shipped by water and shipped by land. And people began to realize that the railroads could not only open up new horizons, create new communities, but were faster than any of these other forms of transportation, which bottom line ended up being more profit, more dollars in the pocket. And businessmen began to look at it from the standpoint, hey, that the railroads can make us money, and therefore, as a private investor, I need to look into this.
And in terms of carrying freight all over the country, let's talk about the freight lines for a moment, Peter. Did people realize early on that this would be good for the economy in various parts of the country? Was it easier to sell freight?
Yeah, I think there was a widespread recognition that this could be very good for the economy. Again, I'll take you way back in history, this time to 1825. The Erie Canal opens up. It connects New York City with the Great Lakes. And because you have access to the Great Lakes, suddenly you have access to, you know, places like Lake Michigan. And because of that, cities all along the eastern seaboard were looking for ways to compete with New York City economically. Not all of them, really, essentially none of them had the kind of water access that New York had with the Erie Canal, and they began to look to railroads as an alternative. And so you have the city of Philadelphia and its merchant class coming together with the Pennsylvania Railroad. In Baltimore, it was the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, and so on. All of them were trying to reach the interior of the United States, and if they didn't have water access, then railroads were the way they wanted to go. And then eventually, by the time you get to about 1840 or so, it's recognized that railroads actually have considerable advantages. Even if you did have the option of water access, water still freezes. And railroads, as you pointed out, Kathleen, were a better all-weather alternative.
Mm-hmm. Was Abraham Lincoln a big champion, and if so, how, I believe he was, of the railroad?
He was. He had been a big champion of what were called in those days internal improvements. Wanted to develop the interior of the country. Lincoln, of course, came from a frontier state. He appreciated the importance of transportation in developing a frontier economy. And so early on, actually in his very first campaign for public office in 1832, he thought Illinois should have railroads. When he got into the state legislature, he was a strong backer of a plan in 1837 that would have developed a statewide network. And then as a lawyer, he took sort of a hiatus from politics during the late 1840s, early 1850s. And his law practice was built largely around railroads. He most often represented them. On occasion, he opposed them. But he was a very big believer in railroads. And then, of course, when you go into his presidency, he is a very strong supporter of the Transcontinental Railroad.
And what about the political battle? Let's go back to the 1800s for a while. Was it as vociferous as it is in Wisconsin in 2010?
that's a really good question, and I probably ought to let Daniel answer that.
You know, if we look at the, let's just focus on the Transcontinental Railroad. The battle around that particular route, not only where it was going to go, which resulted in fights literally between communities, even down to neighbor as to whose land was going to abut where the railroad went. You had things like land speculation. In fact, an interesting one in Wisconsin and northern Minnesota history leading up to deciding where the route of the Transcontinental Railroad was actually going to go, around Superior and Duluth, the great Senator Stephen Douglas, who obviously had influence over what was going to happen with the Transcontinental Railroad, bought up land thinking that the origin of the Transcontinental Road might be around Duluth or Superior, and if he had land, he could stand to fortune from it quite greatly. You look to the 1850s, the early part of the 1850s, and when looking for a route for the railroad, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was charged by Congress with conducting a number of surveys to the west, seeking out a possible route. At the time, the Secretary of War was Jefferson Davis, and when the reports came back from these surveys to the west, Jeff Davis recommended a route to the south. And so it was incredibly politically charged. In fact, I think if you look through all of the history and really trace it down, you could say that the Transcontinental Railroad and its route did have not necessarily a major, but a role in the secession of the southern states.
Oh, isn't that fascinating?
And so, yeah, actually, and if I may jump in, Kathleen,
yes, of course.
I put it even stronger than that, though, Daniel. I think that it really was the issue that brought to a head the sectional tensions that had been simmering really ever since the very beginnings of the Republic. It's fairly widely recognized that the Kansas-Nebraska Act was something that really kind of lit the match to the fuse of the Civil War. But the issue that underlay the Kansas-Nebraska Act was this question of where we build the Transcontinental Railroad.
Sure.
And are we going to build it through slave territory or free territory? Is it going to originate in a slave state or a free state? It was the divisive issue of the 1850s as to where we build this railroad.
Wow.
It didn't get built until the 1860s precisely because Congress could not agree on a route until the South seceded. And once they did, then very quickly the remaining northern congressmen and senators coalesced around this central route that began at Omaha and terminated at Sacramento.
Skip the South, huh?
Yeah.
What would have happened if Stephen Douglas had had his way? How would that have changed Wisconsin, do you think?
Well, when you look at the speculation of where that route should have gone, and if we take a step back to, say, the 1830s, when Wisconsin was beginning to develop as a territory, the idea of a railroad in Wisconsin, in fact, the first one, was really to link the waterways. And if the route had ended up in northern Wisconsin, I think you would have seen a railroad that really was linking the Great Lakes, the Mississippi River, and then taking across land across the northern frontier. It probably would have made a significant difference in what the Twin Cities, Minneapolis-St. Paul, of course, Duluth-Superior, and most of western Wisconsin looks like today. The thing I think we've got to remember in railroads in our country, from early on, the goal of virtually all railroads was to get to Chicago. It was a geographical center, if you will, for the railroads, and it still is. And until we got away from the idea of, and I guess to use the term, early intermodal transportation between rail and water, and realized, as Peter had said, that the railroads could support us across land, it was kind of an up-for-grabs situation. Whoever got that line was going to be the one that was going to prosper.
Hmm.
Yeah, and there were other things that entered into it as well, and that's an excellent point, Daniel. But the other thing that I think is not as well recognized is that railroads changed the transportation habits of the country, that even in the Midwest and even extending in some cases into the upper Midwest, access to the Mississippi-Missouri river system was really the agent of development before the railroads. And so you had farmers in the Mississippi and Ohio valleys who were sending their produce to market downriver and selling it in New Orleans. That was a huge boon to the southern economy. When railroads began building west, it really changed the commerce of the country from more of a north-south model to an east-west model. It really changed the geographic psyche of America, and we began thinking in terms of east and west instead of in terms of north and south commerce.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests. We're looking at the history of the railroad in America, and with special emphasis on Wisconsin, of course, as we debate the future of the railroad in Wisconsin now. We have two guests with us. Peter Hansen is editor of Railroad History, the scholarly journal of the Railway and Locomotive Historical Society, and a correspondent for Trains Magazine, a contributor to the Encyclopedia of North American Railroads. Bob Lettenberger is also with us. Bob is education and volunteer services coordinator for the wonderful National Railroad Museum, which is based in our state, in Green Bay. Here's our phone number. Join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. I guess we've always already learned that railroads have been a contentious issue for a long, long time. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
On the old Milwaukee Road, on the old Milwaukee Road, traveling across the countryside, my oh my, what a wonderful ride. When you hear that diner call, an invitation to you all, hear that whistle tootin' low, get your honey.
Ooh, that is catchy. Our guests this hour are Bob Lettenberger, Education Volunteer Services Coordinator for the National Railroad Museum in Green Bay, Peter Hansen, Editor of Railroad History. And let's go to an email because it is something that comes to mind when you hear that song. Gentlemen, why did the railroads dismantle so many of their tracks in Wisconsin and then let the DNR use those tracks for recreation trails? Why didn't they save those tracks just in case they might be able to expand again and use them in the future? Bob, you want to start?
It's really an economic issue. Just as there are towns that were created by the railroads, business leaving towns caused the railroads to leave as well. Back to, you know, some of what Peter was saying at the beginning about competition with other modes of transportation. Quite frankly, the highways and trucks became the preferred mode because the schedule was a little more flexible. The amount of cargo that could be moved was a little less than in some cases was required to make a railroad economical. And a lot of the tracks came up because it takes literally money to maintain them, whether you're using them or not. And if they were just left in place, in some cases, it's a gamble for the railroads. You know, do we leave them there and play a gamble that we will get business back on that line, at which time we'd have to go through and perform maintenance to bring them back up to a standard that we would operate, be able to operate on? Or do we, as a business, apply our resources elsewhere? And I think Peter and I have both touched on this, but I think something for everyone to very clearly understand about railroads in our country, even though we're talking nowadays about government-funded, government-aided high-speed rail, we have Amtrak as our passenger, long-distance passenger entity in our country, which is a quasi-governmental organization. The railroads in our country are fundamentally a private industry. Mm-hmm. And even though they are government-regulated in many ways, not as much today as they were in past years, but this is a private business. And so they are making decisions based on their profitability, serving their customers, and in a lot of cases, in the interest of their stockholders. So, you know, to make decisions to leave tracks in one place or another, it's a business decision in most cases.
Should it be a private business, do you think, Peter?
Well, yeah, and I think Bob makes a good point there. And, you know, that our privately run freight railroads are really the envy of the world. There's nothing quite like them anywhere.
Really?
Yeah, we rely on our railroads far more than any other country does. You know, with perhaps, you know, even the exception of Canada, which is a lot like us in terms of the North American geography, the expanse of space that needs to be covered and so forth. But, you know, just to take an example that we may all be familiar with, you may have, you know, been stopped at a grade crossing by a passing train, and you see these container trains, these shipping containers that are stacked one on top of the other. They call them double-stack trains. Well, one of those trains can easily carry a couple hundred containers, and that's a couple hundred trucks that aren't on the highways anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The railroads, on average, and it depends on a variety of factors, you know, but on average, railroads are anywhere between 3 and 7 times more fuel efficient and therefore cleaner than highway transportation. So we all do benefit from a really good freight rail infrastructure in this country. And the challenge for policymakers and for the freight railroads going forward is to try to integrate that freight infrastructure and allow the railroads to continue doing that job they do so well, while serving the public with efficient passenger transportation also.
Yeah, well, what about the passenger train transportation? Is that crucial, too, in terms of moving into clean energy, moving people off roads that may be very congested?
You know, I would make the point that we are practically the only industrial country in the world that does not have a network of high-speed passenger trains anymore.
We are?
Yeah, that's practically true. I mean, the only place we have high-speed rail is in the Northeast Corridor between Boston and Washington. And by world standards, that's not even considered high-speed anymore. High-speed now is getting up around 180, 200 miles an hour.
Woo!
In the Northeast Corridor, typically the trains, well, there's only one brief section where they'll even go 150. You know, we are very much behind the rest of the world in terms of passenger rail. Deeply ironic considering that just a couple of generations ago, as you pointed out at the outset, Kathleen, our passenger rail system was was tops. It was the envy of the world in those days.
Yeah. And do you want to weigh in on this, Bob? Why is that?
There's a couple of things here, and I'm going to throw a couple of statistics on just to enhance some of the points here. American Association of Railroads is currently reporting that 43% of the freight in our country is being handled by the railroads. And when you think about that, of all that is being moved, 43%, yeah, it's less than half, but there is
still
some
a lot.
Significant tonnage that the railroads are moving in our country. You know, I think the other thing to look at as far as high-speed rail, quotes around that, what we have had, what the rest of the world is doing, if you look at Europe, who in a lot of cases is kind of the model that I think we in America here aspire to, much smaller land mass in some ways, much more densely populated. But when you distill it down, some of the distances in Europe are very similar to distances that we have here in the U.S. And I think, as Peter had said, it's a matter of public policy that we chose to embrace highways, we chose to embrace the airports and put funding into that as opposed to concentrate on the railroads. And I think kind of the ironic thing to look at, if you go back to the 70s and the 80s and you look at Germany, Lufthansa, the German airline, actually had a financial interest in one of the German railroads. And the model that they projected at the time was, look, if you're taking a trip that is up to 500 miles, take a train, go that distance. Oh, and by the way, Lufthansa, we happen to have an interest in that, so, you know, economically we're going to benefit from it anyway.
Sure.
If you're going over 500 miles, take a train to an airport and get on one of our airplanes. And, you know, either way they're going to benefit. And I think if you look at it in our country here, one of the key things is going to be at what point does taking the train cost less and is more expedient than taking a plane or a car. And if we go back to the Northeast Corridor where Amtrak is running today, the Acela trains, if you compare that to something that, again, started back in the, you know, in the 70s, the old Eastern Airlines had the New York to D.C. shuttle. Hey, we can get you from Washington, D.C. to New York in an hour. That service still exists today, but when you look at that, that trip from downtown D.C. into downtown Manhattan, door-to-door on the airplane is 2-3 hours with everything you need to go to, and you can hop on the Acela for a lesser fare and get there in less time. Now the railroad becomes viable.
Sure it does.
And
sure.
If we can see that kind of thinking permeate the rest of the country, you know, here in Wisconsin, the ultimate plan for that Midwest rail corridor that is being spoken of is that somewhere down the line, we should be able to go from downtown Milwaukee to downtown Chicago in about 36 minutes.
Woo!
Now, when we get to that point, now we're looking at trains like the TGVs in France or the ICE trains in Germany, and that's obviously quite a ways off. But there again, that's the model of what it's going to take really to pry us out of our automobiles and make another mode of transportation more attractive
right.
to us.
Let's go to phone calls. Jeff in La Crosse. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. I've got one comment and a couple questions. First of all, I used to be a conductor on Burlington Northern Railroad for about 17 years.
Oh.
Some of the guys that I worked with had said that there used to be a land speed record on the old CB&Q line between Père du Chien and La Crosse. I always thought that true, not totally sure that that is. But the one of the other things I wanted to ask about is I remember about 10, 15 years ago there was a show on PBS about how the some politicians and some owners of the road builders and corporations that were building cars and buses and trucks colluded to sabotage some of the old trolleys and passenger trains back in the early days. And then also, I talked to an econ professor here in La Crosse, and he said that because of the population distribution and size of the U.S., that passenger train service here is really not viable. So I just wanted to...
Okay, Jeff.
Yeah.
Thank you. Peter, you want to start?
Taking the last one first, you know, I want to echo something that Bob said a minute ago, and that is that, you know, I think passenger service is viable. It's just a question of where we choose to put our funding. Obviously, people are not going to ride trains in very great numbers from New York to San Francisco. They will, however, ride from Chicago to Milwaukee, Chicago to the Twin Cities, Chicago, St. Louis, Kansas City, Louisville, Cleveland. The list goes on. On the East Coast, there are a whole variety of other corridors. On the West Coast, there are more corridors still. Generally speaking, if we build high-speed rail, then it becomes a viable option for trips of under 500 miles or so. And, you know, another thing that we really need to do a better job of is integrating our air transportation and our rail transportation, just as Bob was saying. We're seeing a little bit of that at Mitchell Field already. There are people from the Chicago area who take the train up to Mitchell and fly out of there rather than hassle with O'Hare.
Sure.
You know, because the fact is that we've reached the practical limits in many markets of air travel. There just aren't enough spaces in the skies to put all the airplanes anymore.
Oh, that's interesting. Plus, you got to go through the hassle of, you know, get there 2 hours early, and you got to get searched, and it gets more and more difficult to fly to travel that way.
Right, absolutely. And Jeff's other point about the high-speed service around Père du Chien, that is true. At one point, it wasn't, as far as I can recall, it wasn't actually a land speed record, but what it was the fastest regularly scheduled passenger service in America and one of the fastest in the world, maybe the fastest in the world.
Hmm. I can't remember which one of you said that people were worried they were going to slip into unconsciousness when once a train went 25 to 30 miles an hour. I've never been on one of these high-speed trains. Do people have that same worry that it's just way too fast?
From my understanding of what some of the higher-speed trains are today, like the TGV in France or the tunnel train between London and Paris, the ride is supposed to be incredibly smooth, and it's something that when you get to that level, it is not only the vehicle itself, but it is the entire infrastructure working with the vehicle to provide a smooth and more importantly, safe ride. It all has to be very carefully in tune, to my understanding, to achieve some of those speeds. Just to throw out a couple of numbers here, we're talking about speed records. Actually, the world speed record for a steam locomotive is held by a locomotive called the Mallard, which is currently on display at the National Railway Museum in York, England. That record is just a touch under 127 miles an hour. We have a sister to the Mallard here at the National Railroad Museum, the locomotive Dwight D. Eisenhower. And then also, we've been bandying about some of the trains in Europe here this morning, especially the French TGVs. You are looking at speeds there, in fact, record speeds there of around 350 miles an hour.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. That stops me in my tracks. Let's go to Tim from Wausau. Hi, Tim. Hello, Tim. Are you there? Yeah, Tim is not there. So let's go to John in Stoughton. Hi, John.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, hi, guys.
Good morning.
The fellow touched on it briefly in his question just a second ago, actually. I thought he was going to steal my thunder, but I don't know that much about, you know, rails and all that. I did study a little bit after that because of the high-speed rail in Wisconsin, and I was, when I started to look into it, I came across this unbelievable story called the Great American Streetcar Scandal, and where GM started buying up streetcars in 1930s already, and they were convicted in the late 1940s, convicted, and they were fined like a dollar a piece, and it was like GM and Firestone and some oil companies and Mack Trucks and a bunch of companies, and they actually bought all the streetcars, bought all the rail, light rail, and some of the heavier rail, actually, and they dismantled it and replaced it with buses, trucks, and taxi systems.
Hmm. Is that true, Peter?
It's still a very disputed point, but one thing that I think is beyond dispute, and I'm not weighing in one way or the other on it. I'm sort of agnostic on the question. But one thing that's beyond dispute, I think, is that we have a powerful array of forces in favor of highway transportation, and they include everything from automakers and oil companies to steel companies and glass companies and plastics and so forth. And because all of those things go into cars and go into, you know, automotive transportation, there is no similar lobby that speaks for passenger rail. Passenger rail is really more of a grassroots effort. It is something that arose more or less spontaneously in this country because there were people who were looking at what was going on in the rest of the world and saying, "Why can't we do that here?"
I think that
you see some of this actually reflected in current public policy as well. There is no dedicated, stable funding source for passenger rail in this country.
Right.
Whereas every time we pump a gallon of gas, we're paying into the motor fuels taxes, both on the federal and the state levels. Every time we buy an airline ticket, we're supporting the FAA with a ticket tax. And, you know, all of those things are very necessary in order to maintain the infrastructure that we have. But we have no similar funding mechanism for rail. And until we do, then I think that rail is always going to struggle in this country, passenger rail.
Mm-hmm. But Peter, isn't it, how can you be an agnostic on what John just brought up? That story, it seems to me, could be pretty easily verified or found to be not true.
Well, it is true that General Motors, through a subsidiary called National City Lines, did buy up urban transit systems around the country and converted them over to buses. Whether that was a conspiracy on their part to run the trolley systems out of business, that's the point that's sort of in dispute. General Motors' defense always was, well, once we owned these things, we found that, you know, that light rail or the fixed rail systems were just not economically viable, and that's why we replaced them with buses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that the courts fined General Motors only a minimal amount seems to suggest that, well, okay, there may have been some culpability there, but, you know, even the court itself seemed not to be too sure of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't know. I've read a lot about it, pro and con, and honestly, I don't have a conclusion.
Okay. John, thank you very much. Interesting point. Let's go next to Bob in Wauwatosa. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. I'd like your guest to please explain to us why, with all of the modern trains in Europe, why are we so inept at developing good railroads here? Why is it that in France and Germany and Italy, they have lots of at-grade crossings and manage to deal with it as far as right-of-way problems go? Why can't we deal with those problems? What is holding us back? We're just backward when it comes to putting in fast trains. I'll take my answer off the air. Hope
okay.
you can help.
Thanks, Bob. Let's go to you, Bob.
I think there's a couple of things that come into play here, and we've kind of been dancing around this through our conversation this morning. And it comes down to one thing. When you look at the countries in Europe, they have integrated national transportation policies. And we here in the U.S., because of how we developed railroads, because of the lobbying institutions that Peter has talked about, we have kind of been hodgepodge. And you couple that with and the GM piece that we just talked about leads into it so perfectly. You have private industry who is trying to make money off of the transportation realm in our country, and GM, who not only made buses, but at the same time that this conspiracy was, in theory, going on, was also one of the leading manufacturers of railroad locomotives here in the nation.
Mm-hmm.
One can see how the lobbies are going to weigh out and how the private interests are going to outweigh a overall comprehensive plan for the public good. And, you know, in Europe, where they have also done things like, and I'll take Germany, for example, you know, a Ford Fiesta over in Germany costs about $30,000. A driver's license, I am told, is going for about $300. A gallon of gas, depending on, you know, where we are, is, you know, $7-$8 a gallon. They have made it a national transportation policy that they're going to direct the citizens into certain modes of transportation. We haven't necessarily done that here in our country. And you look at how some of the bright and shining spots in transportation today are coming up, and they're local initiatives. We talked a minute ago about the idea of linking air and rail, and you look at some of the light rail systems that are being developed around our country, and I'll take Minneapolis-St. Paul as a prime example. They put in a light rail system between downtown, the business district, and the airport. And, again, a local initiative to ease a problem locally, whereas the countries in Europe are thinking on a national basis. And I think that's the big spot where we have missed or dropped the ball here in our country.
Mm-hmm. So we may need, what do both of you think, and what would be the impediments to putting together some kind of integrated transportation policy bureau or something in the government? It sounds like we may need that or not. It wouldn't be an easy thing to do.
Well, I think it probably would not be an easy thing to do because it really means getting everybody in what is a system that has governmental involvement,
right.
Traditionally has private involvement,
mm-hmm.
and then has consumer preference involved to come to the table and find a common ground compromise. You go all the way back to the Transcontinental Railroad in our country and the debate over exactly where the line should go. You know, that still exists today. So the bigger question is that to bring everybody to a central point thinking and realize this is what we need. And quite frankly, you know, we can see it like with Amtrak's Excella on the east in the northeast corridor, the airways are clogged. So let's find an alternative. It's the same with our automobiles. We fell in love with them because we no longer wanted to travel on railroad time. We wanted to have our freedom and go when we wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
Going to take a bit to get us all together and pry us out of our cars.
Ooh, it sure is, isn't it, Peter? There's an understatement.
Absolutely. And I think that if I could home in on two reasons why I think that we're going to have a hard time with passenger rail in this country. It's not to say that it can't be done, but there are two big issues. The first we've already talked about, and that's the funding issue. Just as an aside, in the last 2-3 weeks or so, we have seen high-speed rail initiatives or other rail initiatives killed in three different states by governors or governors-elect who did not agree with the plan. Wisconsin's one of them. It also happened in Ohio, and it also happened in New Jersey.
Right.
And it's all just within the last month or so.
Yeah.
And if we had more of a national policy and more of a national funding mechanism, then those governors may not have had the concerns that they had. The other thing that I think is going to that is going to be an issue we'll have to grapple with is how we integrate high speed passenger trains with freight trains on the same tracks. Generally speaking, you can probably integrate higher speed passenger trains up to, say, 110 miles an hour. You can integrate those on existing freight tracks in many cases. When you start getting above 110, you start talking about a dedicated right-of-way just for passenger service.
I see.
That issue of how we integrate this with freight service along with the funding, I think those are the two big issues we're going to have to resolve in order to get high-speed rail in this country.
We're going to welcome more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. The history of rail in this country this hour. Peter Hansen, editor of Railroad History, the scholarly journal of the Railway and Locomotive Historical Society, and a correspondent for Trains Magazine. Bob Lettenberger is education and volunteer services coordinator of the National Railroad Museum, which is located in Green Bay, Wisconsin. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're a rugged mass of molded steel. You're an intricate web of precision-tested gears and wheels. You're a Hercules, Atlas, Samson, Goliath, and then some. You've the power of a cavalry charge under your hood. You're a locomotive. These are the trains you haul, passenger and freight.
From a 1953 newsreel, of course, on trains. And that's what we're talking about. Before we go back to phone calls, I've been wondering, because not too many people have done a history of this high-speed rail in Wisconsin. What kinds of plans are there for high-speed rail? Did somebody come up with a plan? I know it's part of the stimulus money here, but who's behind all of this, and what's the grand design? Peter? Do you know, or I'm sure you guys know?
I would say that there are some grassroots groups that we have talked about before. There's an outfit called the National Association of Railroad Passengers. They have been instrumental in lobbying for high-speed rail in a number of jurisdictions. As to the specifics of how exactly the Wisconsin plan came together, I'm in Kansas City. I view Wisconsin from afar. Bob might be a better
Bob, do you know?
There has been for probably about 10 to 20 years now a group here in the upper Midwest, but the Midwest High Speed Rail Association. I've also heard them, the Midwest High Speed Rail Consortium. There has been a plan that has been laid on the table that has really involved not only private but public entities from the upper Midwest, and their plan really is a hub and spoke system generating out of Chicago, heading out to the major cities around the upper Midwest. Peter, in fact, actually even getting down to Kansas City at some point in time, if we get that far. And it goes back to that idea of 500 miles or less, take the train, and you know, beyond that, take it to an airport, take a plane. The group is really, when you look at the entire plan, some of the information that I've seen of late, obviously here in Wisconsin, the step between Madison and Milwaukee was to be a first step in what eventually would be a line going from Chicago out to the Twin Cities. Interestingly enough, the entity in France, and I'll probably get the initials right or wrong here, SCNF, that runs the TGF or the TGV trains, the high-speed ones in France, actually had put together, has put together a business proposal for the Midwest rail corridors involving high-speed rail. So there's a plan out there. There's a lot of lobbying, and I think depending upon which way the current project between Milwaukee and Madison ends up going, we may have a first step sooner or later.
Let's go to...
Of course, if I may, Bob, the SNCF was not the only consortium that is bidding on producing high-speed trains here in the U.S. I mean, just in Milwaukee, you know, Talgo.
Talgo,
Spanish,
yes.
Yeah, the Spanish manufacturer had planned to locate a manufacturing facility. That is in doubt now, with you know, Governor-elect Walker's decision not to fund passenger rail. So, you know, there are a variety of organizations that do want to jump in and are prepared to, but they need to see a little more commitment from us.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Don in Warren, Illinois. Hi, Don.
Hi. Here we are reinventing the wheel again. In the mid-30s, they built a train, the Burlington Zephyr, and it was powered by a specially built 600-horse diesel, which is about the size of the late model semis used today. The whole train weighed about as much as a GE diesel does today. That's the whole smear. I saw the train orders, and between La Crosse and Prairie, do not exceed 125 miles an hour. So here we are 75 years later talking about high-speed rail. We already had it and got rid of it.
Yeah, ain't that something, Bob?
Kathleen, the gentleman is absolutely so right. And I'll bring in one other piece, in fact, an interesting piece that we have here in our collection at the museum, the General Motors Aero Train. The gentleman's absolutely right. The Zephyr was lightweight. It was high speed. Come to the 1950s, General Motors, the same folks that we just talked about a few minutes ago, in theory conspiring to do away with public transportation, developed a lightweight, high speed unit to essentially attain the 500-mile market. At the time that the Aerotrain was being developed, the Rock Island Railroad here in our country tested out a Spanish-made Talgo train, and all of it was literally sent packing. Interestingly enough, when Amtrak was looking for a lightweight, high-tech train for the Pacific Northwest in the 1980s, they began using Spanish Talgo technology. So, yeah, in many ways, we're reinventing the wheel here.
Yeah. How's business at the National Railroad Museum picking up lately?
We're doing very well. You know, we have we obviously have our seasons and whatnot, you know, as our facilities expand over the next few years, you're going to see more wintertime programming from us. Another big emphasis and something that I'm directly involved with is obviously our educational programming, and we have some very interesting untapped markets that we want to look at educationally. Definitely want to explore the whole relation between math and science and the railroads, and you know, it offers some new and creative ways to look at what students are learning in their curriculum today. Another thing, and we've been talking very much about technology here this morning and public philosophy, but you know, the railroads have played a great role in art and music and our cultural development in this country.
True.
And that's something else that we here at the National Railroad Museum want to take a look at through some of our educational programs.
My Uncle Dan O'Leary, for 50 years, was a conductor in the Chicago Northwestern, and his contribution was to make everybody in his cars sing Irish songs. I thought that was great. They love the guy. Oh, thank you so much. It is amazing that this, to me, that this is such a hugely controversial issue in the state of Wisconsin right now. But it was fascinating to learn about the history, and we just touched the surface. I thank you both so much. It was a great hour.
Pleasure being with you this morning.
Thank you. Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
Yeah. Our guest, Bob Lettenberger, Education and Volunteer Services Coordinator of the National Railroad Museum in Green Bay. You can go online if you want to see the nationalmuseum.org is their website. And Peter Hansen is editor of Railroad History, the scholarly journal of the Railway and Locomotive Historical Society. Interesting hour. Thanks very much to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. And thanks also to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll have more conversation following the news.
An invitation to you all. Hear that whistle tootin' low.